We talk a lot on this podcast about chess improvement, but when it comes to improving your hiring processes, Indeed is the platform you need. Indeed has over 350 million global monthly visitors, and it has a matching engine that helps you find quality work candidates fast. You can use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with your candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree that Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Years ago, when I was running a chess teaching business, I found it hard to find good help, and I had to go through a lot of back and forth to even screen potential candidates. Indeed allows you to do those things efficiently in one place. Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed for hiring, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of Perpetual Chess will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility if you go to Indeed.com/chess. Just go to Indeed.com/chess right now, and you'll be supporting our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast, Indeed.com/chess. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone. I am Ben Johnson, and this is the Perpetual Chess Podcast. Perpetual Chess is a weekly interview show where top chess players, authors, content creators, and accomplished amateurs discuss their careers and share stories and chess improvement tips. Perpetual Chess is a part of the Blue Wire Podcast Network, and we'd like to give special thanks to our presenting chess education sponsor, Chessable.com. For more information about the show, you can go to PerpetualChessPod.com. But without further ado, let's get to the show. And we are here today with a legendary author in the chess world. He is 89 years of age, best known for being the co-author of the absolutely legendary book. Some consider it possibly to be the best-selling chess book of all time, Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess. It, of course, was written along with Don Mosenfelder and a certain Bobby Fischer, first published in 1966. This book was my first chess book, as it has been for so many others. And more importantly, it's often cited again as the best-selling chess book of all time, well over 1 million copies sold. Our guest is also a USCF master and an educational psychologist who's written and published a lot about educational technology and even specifically about the effect of chess on reading scores and other related topics. So I am super excited to welcome to the show Dr. Stuart Margulies. Stuart, how are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm very excited to be talking about chess.
Yes, and I'm so excited that you're still 89 years of age, still healthy and able to share your stories and perspective. We should say we're doing this by phone, but you sound good. Hopefully I sound good for the listeners. I thought this was the best way to do this, and I'm really excited to hear your perspective, Stuart.
Well, I'm hopeful that there'll be things that will come up that I won't misremember, because some of my first connections with Bobby, first playing with Bobby is probably, 60 years ago or something more than that, perhaps. He was about 15. I would have been about 25. So that would be 60 years ago that my first contacts with Bobby were. And I don't know how well I'll remember what it was like.
Well, let's hear it. So what is, when you think of your first encounter of Bobby Fischer, now, obviously, as you say, many decades have passed, so it's possible you won't remember the very first encounter, but Do you recall either your first time seeing Bobby Fischer or your first time hearing about him, which I'm guessing might have preceded seeing him?
Yeah, Alan Kaufman's wife was a fan of his, and Jack Collins, Bobby used to go to Jack Collins' house, and that's where I played with him much. And Jack Collins' house was quite near my uncle's house, so I could easily pop over there and get to play with this kid, who gave me, even from the beginning, big odds. And here I was, a reasonable chess master, and I was being easily demolished, even at the odds he gave me, by this kid.
And were you guys using a chess clock, Stuart, or what kind of odds did he, how did he give
you?
You know,
I don't remember if we were using, it's one of the things I don't remember. We were using a chess clock a lot of the time. I presume that we were playing 5-minute chess mostly at that time, but I cannot actually remember if that's what we did. It was quite common around that time just to not use clocks but to count. You know, we play 10 seconds, and people would say, count to themselves, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, move, 1, 2, 3. You know, a lot of chess was played with that 10-second kind of thing. But I think when I played Bobby, I played almost always with a clock. And most of the games that I played with Bobby in the early years were his giving me big odds. And typically, he gave, at 5-minute chess, typically he was giving me pawn and four moves, which was almost inconceivable. You know, after you play the first four moves, you think to yourself, I could pass now there. I've already got both knights developed and got the center pawns out there. But what's this kid going to do? But, you know, I certainly got a minus score at being given pawn and four.
No, I guess you weren't allowed to bring out your bishop and queen and checkmate him under those circumstances.
No, you weren't allowed to move past the fourth rank, but Asa Hoffman found a way of playing when he was giving four to him, and Bobby also gave Asa four, pawn and four, which was ridiculous because Asa was so much better than me. But Asa found a way of playing which devastated Bobby at pawn and four. Asa played, don't know if it's worth repeating for everybody, but Asa played in E3, C3, Queen C2, and Bishop D3. And for people who are able to visualize that position, you could see that there's just not anything that Black can do. And I think after Asa found this way of playing, Bobby stopped giving pawn and four. Although every time he gave me pawn and four after that, I never used Asa's system. I just developed my center pawns and my knights and played that way. But Asa's system was devastating.
I guess, is Black missing their F7 pawn? Is that the issue?
Yes, Black's missing their F7 pawn, and with the queen at C2 and the bishop at D3, it's just hopeless for Black.
What happens? Sorry to derail this, but what happens after knight F6?
Well, after knight F6, he played bishop checkmate. Bishop check in the next move.
Oh, yeah,
made.
The diagonal's open. Yeah, you sack your bishop. Very funny. Okay. Yeah, that was a nice little blindfold puzzle that you gave us, Stuart, which I failed. But that's amazing to hear. So Fischer, 15 years of age, of course, that's famously the age where he became the youngest grandmaster. So, like, what was his degree of fame at that point, Stuart?
I don't really know. I don't have any good sense anymore of how famous he was at the time. I mean, I lived in a little world in which he was famous, but I don't know about in the rest of the world. Just can't say. To a small circle of people, he was just spectacular, but I don't know how large the circle was.
Right. And what was his personality like in those days?
Oh, gosh. So my memory is so crystal clear. What a nice kid he was, and the arguments, the discussions later, I often hear about difficulties with Bobby. I had none of that at all, no hint whatsoever of any of that. In fact, when we started to do the book, and usually, I've done a lot of books, and usually authors are just one big pain in the neck because they want to do it this way and that way and the other way. Very intelligent, but difficult. But Bobby was very easy, very easy. He only had one or two things he was very insistent on, and except for that, he was just a pleasure. Look at the position, and it would be fine with him. What we were saying was fine with him. But he did have one requirement, and that was, although Don Mosenfelder and Les Ault and I were all chess masters, and we were working on the book, and we were very unlikely, it was a book for beginners, we were very unlikely to be doing something that was an error of any kind. And yet Bobby insisted that we get two stronger masters than any of the three of us who would proofread every page. He absolutely wouldn't tolerate any errors. So Raymond Weinstein and Michael Valvo got hired, and they went through every page carefully. And, of course, nobody ever found anything wrong, but Bobby was content.
Yeah, there's so many fascinating things about the history of your book, Stuart. And one of them to me, and what you just mentioned is alluded to, the book has its own Wikipedia page, and it is alluded to on that. And to have five people working on a chess book in the early to mid-1960s struck me as unusual. It wasn't big.
Unusual, puts it mildly, yeah.
Yeah, chess wasn't big business at the time. So how did this come about, and was it hard to get the publisher to bring in even additional people, as you said?
Circumstances were very unusual, having nothing to do with chess, but programmed instruction that B.F. Skinner had developed was the format we were using in this book. Most people today, in fact, nobody today, would look at the book and recognize, they might say, see it's a little different than they've ever seen, but they would never recognize that it was done in the format of program instruction that B.F. Skinner had presented. And I was a program instruction author and working for Xerox, and Xerox found this was going to be a new way of showing program instruction. Or, you know, most of the time, the books that I was doing were how the salesman should best present the product in program instruction form. That was the kind of work we were doing. But here was just something completely different, a chess book in programmed instruction. So, of course, for Xerox, the money was no issue at all. They hired Bobby to go on television and play games at Speed Chess and then talk about the book. The money problems were zero so far as Xerox was concerned, but that's how it happened that we got a great deal of publishing support.
Okay, and of course this is your life's work, Stuart, but for our listeners, could you define program instruction or program learning?
Awfully hard to, it's easy if you show some people some of it and look at it for 5 or 10 minutes. It'll be harder to say if people don't know, but essentially each step, everything is broken into many small steps, and nobody ever makes an error in any small step. They are correct all the time, essentially 100% correct. Indeed, when we first did Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess, the first few pages where we would show people what a checkmate was, when we tested it out on people, and one of the things you do in program instruction is a lot of testing, we tested it out on people. Some of the people found it very hard to go from page 1 to page 2 to page 3. So we had to put in between pages to make it easier. And essentially, what was started as page 1 to 2 became something like page 1 to 12, page 1 to 15. So people could do it and not make any errors. And that's the characteristic of program instruction. Very small steps, carefully tested on a lot of people, and no errors along the way.
Right, and quick feedback, like with the answers given right away, right?
Yeah, that's right. Quick feedback with the answers given. We had a lot of trouble because, as people will have noticed, half the pages are upside down,
right?
Because we had to do it so that people couldn't see the answer on the next page. But all of those were unique kind of things, because most times people who were writing chess books were doing it with careful notation, you know, Puente King 4, Puente King 3. There's no notation in the book, and most of the pictures are just one picture on a page, which was extremely... Pandolfini said, that's how I'm going to do my books now, on one picture at a page is plenty. So it was different in that way. Of course, whatever it might have been, the enthusiasm of chess playing was so great in the Fischer-Spassky thing that it was no surprise that the book really sold well. In fact, if you didn't have a book, if you had like a television show, like Shelby Lyman's show, had a prodigious audience because so many people were interested in the Fischer-Spassky match. I think Shelby said that there was a tennis tournament, a major tennis tournament, on at the same time as Shelby's show, and he had more watchers than the tennis players, which they never got before. So interest was really prodigious.
But, Stuart, that took a while, right? Your book originally published in 1966. So.
Yeah, and it didn't get well received when it first came out. No, we sold only a few thousand copies a year until the Fischer-Spassky match, and then we sold a million copies.
So to paraphrase,
20,000 copies a day we were selling, and 20,000 copies a day was more than we had sold altogether in several years.
Amazing. So to paraphrase Rodney Dangerfield, it took you guys 6 years to become an overnight success.
Yeah, that's right. That's really what happened.
But even these days, I mean, if you sell 10,000 chess books, even with chess doing quite well in the Queen's Gambit era, that's a successful book. And again, it's written on Wikipedia, and you just alluded to it. It sounds like around 10,000 books were sold prior to the match, but you felt like that wasn't that significant in terms of sales, or you just didn't think about it that much?
I thought to myself, whoever expects a lot of a chess book to sell, especially a book in program instruction format, I had no real great... I mean, it was nice to work with Bobby. Who cared about the rest? And somehow to see the sales take off were just unbelievable.
Yeah, amazing.
And, of course, the same for right now. You mentioned again, the first time I've seen in the last 50 years anything like Bobby Fischer... And like the Fischer-Spassky match is, or the Queen's Gambit declined, the Queen's Gambit, rather. But that has a television audience like Shelby had, like the book had. That's the only times in my life that I've seen anything like that.
Yeah, luckily the Queen's Gambit show was not declined. It was accepted by many. So how do you compare these two booms, Stuart? Whenever I have a guest such as the aforementioned Asa Hoffman, who mentions you in the book I discussed with him in a recent interview, The Last Gamesman, your name comes up periodically, of course. But whenever I get a chance to interview people who live through both booms, I'm curious to hear how you compare them, Stuart.
Well, they seem like a review, like the same thing. I don't know. I mean, you go into a coffee shop, you have a cup of coffee, and you listen to people talking in another booth, and they're talking about the Queen's Gambit, just as Shelby Lyman's show had the same kind of thing. And our chess books were like that, too. I just don't know how it happened. I understand that in Capablanca's time, there had been a time when there was a tremendous interest in chess, too, but I didn't live through that.
Right. Okay, well, Stuart, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsors, and then I want to hear more about the background of Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess. Perpetual Chess is proud to be brought to you in part by Chessable.com. Chessable, of course, is the premier chess educational website, which allows you to study all aspects of your game using spaced repetition in order to help you remember opening sequences, tactics, endgames, all that stuff. They've got a bunch of fun new courses out, including Arkell's Endings. Grandmaster Keith Arkell legendary endgame specialist who's been on the pod, nice guy as well. They just adapted his book to the Chessable format. You can learn so much from his endgame, how he grinds down masters and even his fellow grandmasters. Chessable also has a free new course available from Mr. Dodgy, reviewing I Am Eric Rosen's Best Stalemate Tricks. Of course, Eric's known for having a lot of fun endgame stalemate swindles, so you can check those out for free. So whatever aspect of your game you'd like to work on, be sure to go to Chessable.com and check out all their courses available both for free and for purchase.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And we are back. And Stuart, it sounds like, a multi-year project to even write the book. And then, of course, the book has had a life of its own over the intervening years and now decades. But let's hear a bit more about how the actual writing of the book, because there's been different things reported about Bobby's degree of involvement. So I'd love to hear what you could share about what the actual writing process was like with you and your co-authors and collaborators.
Well, Bobby's involvement was modest, but unimportant. But there's one other person who was involved in it, somebody who you interviewed just a few weeks ago, and that was Frank Brady. And Frank, the name of Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess came from Frank Brady. I'm embarrassed to tell you what the working title was before Frank Brady came and made the change, but the working title was Kill with Bobby.
Oh, wow.
And that would never have sold it. Yeah. I mean, we'd be lucky to sell three copies if we kept that title. That shows how little we knew about the world of selling a book until Frank came along and immediately dismissed that. And he suggested Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess. And in fact, that title seems to be kind of catchy, because I now know there's Kasparov Teaches Chess and there's Carlsen Teaches Chess. So Frank Brady's suggestion has borne a lot of fruit.
Yeah, plus it's got the iconic photo on the cover of Fischer playing on the Dubrovnik chess set. I remember, and I'm sure so many people have stories like this. I was fascinated by chess, didn't know there was like a tournament world, didn't know there were books about it from the time I learned when I was 6 until I was 12 when I got that book. And it just opened up a world to me, and something about the book and the cover and who is Bobby Fischer, it just all drew me in. And I'm sure so many have stories like that.
Yeah, I think it really, many people found just what they wanted in it. And Bobby's involvement in it was quite modest, but it was, as he pointed out, the thing he did that was most important is he went along with it. He endorsed it. And he said, that's what people really care about, is that it's me saying this is okay. And it's the same thing with Fischer Random Chess. Bobby is saying, maybe other people have the same idea, but when I say this is something that we should be doing, it has a lot more clout than when somebody published in some obscure part of the world the same kind of idea. So Bobby Fischer's endorsement was important. Also, he made one change that was, I think, important. There's very little pieces most of the time, like a queen and king versus a king or something. And under those conditions, it's very, very bare and no problem. But by the time you get to halfway in the book, there are a lot of pieces around. And when we first did it, we set the pieces up so that it would be easy to figure out what you were going to try to do. And Bobby didn't want that. It wasn't that he was trying to make it difficult. He wanted it to look like it would come from a game. He wanted it to look like pieces, like the amount of material was balanced. And so he made that change, and that was one of the changes. I think that was the most important of the changes he made in changing the shape of the book, because he wasn't really concerned with how fast you went, whether you gave a problem, whether you asked people to solve this for this position with more practice or less practice. He didn't care about any of those things. He granted us the right to do that. His only comments were that it would all be accurate and that it would look like a regular game.
Okay, yeah. And of course, you guys did pull some of Fisher's positions for the book, which, again, since it's a beginner's book, is not, I'm sure it wasn't the easiest task, but like famously, you've got the Fisher-Larsen checkmate that Fisher actually missed, even though it's a, you know, classic game, and he played sparkling chess. He didn't play the fastest checkmate at the end, and that's one of the puzzles included in the book. So for something like that, was it you and Don digging up the position, or was Fisher himself?
No, Don did the main work in figuring out how fast we should go, the main programming. Don is perhaps the best of I've worked with that skill. I've worked with a lot of very, 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 very prominent people, but Don is superb. But no, the person who did all of that was Raymond Weinstein.
Oh, interesting.
And some Mike Valvo. Raymond Weinstein and Mike Valvo worked with Bobby on trying to decide what materials from Bobby's games would be added. And Mike Valvo, in describing Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess, said it was like a cast of thousands, because he and Raymond worked so hard with Bobby to get that to be good. I don't know if you know that Raymond's life ended very tragically.
Yeah.
I didn't have any hint of that.
Yeah. It was certainly a sad story. He killed a man in
That's
the
right.
early 60s, correct?
Yeah, in a halfway house. Yeah, he killed a man.
Jeez.
It's hard to believe it. So easy to be with then, but I guess schizophrenics often have a real sharp turn at around a certain time in their life, and I guess that's what happened with Raymond. I don't really know the details of how he happened to kill somebody in a halfway house.
And do you know if he's still alive in an institution?
I don't know if he's still alive, okay. But I'd be surprised. He was younger than me, but he was very, very overweight when he was in the halfway house, and I just don't know what his health would be like by now, but I'd be surprised if he was still alive.
Yeah, just taking a quick look online, there's no mention of his passing. But anyway, Stuart, I am curious, and you mentioned collaborators such as Raymond Weinstein and Mike Valvo, who I believe I actually played once. I'm curious, people like that, obviously this book has generated a lot of royalties over time. Did they get royalties as well, or was it
No, they were paid a fee.
Okay.
The only royalties were Don Mosenfelder, me, and Bobby.
Okay, yeah, and obviously...
Bobby, one of the things about Bobby that I have somehow seen in papers that I don't feel is correct... But what I would feel is correct is, despite what so many people have said, to say that my experience with Bobby was he had zip interest in the way of money, and also at the same time he had no interest in how much he was getting or this or how to maximize it or thing. Despite all that, I think he was quite resentful that other people were making money from his work. So I don't know how to put the two together. He certainly wasn't trying to push for more money. In fact, at one time, we had the opportunity to serialize the book. And the major publishing house or newspaper house that would have serialized the book, put a position a day throughout the whole match. And they were offering very substantial sums, so that Bobby, who earned about $150,000 in royalties from Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess, would have earned about another $150,000 if he had agreed that we could serialize the book through the newspaper, through the, I'm not sure what this wasn't, I don't think it was Hearst, but one of those major newspaper chains. And yet he turned it down, and he also said he wanted to popularize chess, and this was going to popular. This would have increased the number of readers by 100% if we could have given the newspapers the right to put one position a day in every day. I never understood why he turned it down, and we could never talk to him about it because this was in the middle of the match or in the first stages of the match, and everybody agreed. We didn't want to have any discussion with Bobby about any financial issues, whether he disagreed or not. We didn't want to do anything to distress the match. But I thought if I could talk to him for 5 minutes, he would probably say, I'd love to do it. And who knows what he was told was involved in. He doesn't have much knowledge about a lot of things, or didn't at that time. So I doubt he really understood what was involved. And as I say, it would have doubled his royalties and increased the number of people who would know his name, see his work. But he said no, and we didn't follow up on it.
Wow. Yeah, that must have been disappointing for you personally as well.
Yeah, it was a $75,000 check for me. Yeah, was disappointing. And I would have liked to have more more publicity for it, too. And also, I felt we're getting a no from somebody who, if I could talk to for a minute, would change to a yes. All of that made it disappointing.
Yeah, that whole period sounds like such a maelstrom, the with that match going on. And obviously, this is pre-cell phone age. You can't just text Bobby. You know, you've got to try to get him on the phone halfway across the world. When
we had his lawyer, but we did not feel that we could go through to his lawyer. Just we didn't have a good relationship with his lawyer. Nothing bad, but nothing friendly either.
Right. And how did your relationship with Fischer evolve over the years? Did you ever see him after he became world champion?
No. Never saw him after. I mean, I saw him, of course, in the streets and waved to him and things like that. But no, I never had another minute. I never played another game with him. I played so many games with him before he became world champion, but I never played. You know, I'd say I played many games with him. Probably I played something like 60 games where he gave me not just 1-4. The other times we played, he gave me 10-1. Or we played regular, he'd give me 10-1 and draw odds. And we played and played and played and played, and I finally won one game once the whole time. It was worth a lot to me to finally win a game. My sense is, despite what people said about how he hated to lose, my sense is he was rooting for me. I thought he was really pleased that I finally won a game.
Do you have a record of the game, Stuart?
No, I don't.
I would be writing it down as fast as I could.
I can tell you what the opening was. I don't know if you know the name that we were using then. It was called the Kevitz Defense. I played that and got a good, very good game. And Bobby said to Kevitz about a week later, he said, you know, I'd like to study your work. Stuart plays it against me and he kills me with it. Well, everybody was astonished to think of me killing with it. What he means is I won one game in 60.
Right, that's funny. And Kevitz, can you spell that? I'm not familiar with that opening.
Alexander Kevitz, K-E-V-I-T-Z.
Oh, okay. I'll have
the same opening has now got a new name. They call it the Two Knights Tango now.
Ah, okay. That would explain, yeah, the Black Knights Tango, I guess. That would explain my lack of familiarity. And Stuart, if you don't mind my asking, are you Jewish?
Yes.
Okay. I guessed as much, but of course with Fischer's, unfortunate famed anti-Semitism, especially later in life, did you experience any anti-Semitism from Fischer?
Oh, no. No, not the Fischer I knew wasn't like that at all.
So were there any signs? Of course, we discussed Weinstein's mental health issues. Were there any signs of any sort of imbalance in your encounters with Fisher?
Zero.
Wow.
One time he made a hostile comment, a hostile racial comment. In many, 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 many years of knowing him, that was the only thing. And even then, you know, when I looked up at the thing, he just sort of brushed it aside as if, what did I ever say that for or something? No, none at all of any of it. In fact, in the Marshall Chess Club at the time, we had no black players. And that was in part because various people who were prominent in the club did not want any black players. And finally, several people pushing very hard, like Frank Brady among them, and Jimmy Sherwin and Alan Kaufman, pushing really hard, we got our first black member in the club. And I don't know if you ever heard of any of those things. In fact, I wonder if I could remember his name. But at any rate, his name was Archie Waters. You probably have never heard of him. But you ask about Fisher and his anti-Semitism and his being a member of, connected with the Aryan Nation. So here's Archie Waters, a black guy in the club, and Fisher and Archie Waters get to be really good friends. I don't know who else hung out with Archie Waters more than Bobby, because they used to hang out to play ping pong together. So it's asking about Fisher and me and Jewish. You could even ask more strongly about Fisher and Archie Waters, who just hung out well.
Yeah, and John Donaldson has written that Fisher loved to sing soul music songs. Did you witness that as well?
No, I didn't.
And you know,
but as I say, as you move along to when Fisher becomes world champion and changes his life and so on, I'm no longer in Fisher's life. I don't really know hardly anything. I mean, I don't have any personal contacts except with the young Fisher.
Right. And Asa tells some great stories, both in his book and in our interview, of he, Fisher, and chess players kind of like prowling the streets. You know, you meet at a chess club.
Yeah, prowling the streets to eat.
Yeah. Were you involved in any of those?
Yeah, a little bit. He liked these delis, and somehow he might prowl the street to go to the delis.
But it was early enough where it wasn't creating a stir yet. Fisher wasn't that famous in those days.
I don't have that good a memory of any stir when we went down the streets to go eat in the early years. I just don't have any memory at all of it. And a lot of the time when I was doing and seeing Fisher at Jack Collins' house, so we wouldn't be going out to. But every once in a while, we did go out. Not sure. I mean, there were various guys who were friends of Bobby, some of whom you may have interviewed, like Earl Hall or Jimmy Gore or any of those people, or Zuckerman, of course. But those were the people who would go along with him and of course Frank Brady too would go along, but I didn't know that world very well.
Okay, and you write in the book that it's written in the foreword that you and Mr. Mosenfelder, you guys kind of conceived the book before Fisher was on board. You were looking for a strong player to endorse it and be involved. So how did Fisher's actual involvement come about, Stuart?
I don't know. One day it happened. I don't really know how it happened. And we had no trouble either. We had no trouble with his lawyer, with writing the contract, with any of it. And the contract gave us the right to have it go in the newspaper. And we had this, as I say, the money would have been very substantial and the publicity would have been very substantial. And our lawyers assured us that we had the right to do it. We didn't need to ask Bobby. But everybody had the same feeling. That's all we need is to do something that's going to aggravate Bobby when he's playing Spassky. We better forget it.
So did you ever, like you've mentioned his involvement was minimal, but once you had his endorsement, did you ever like have get-togethers to go over the materials in the book, or was it all done through intermediaries?
I don't think the only people that got involved with him with the book, I think, were Raymond and Mike Valvo. I don't think Don Mosenfeld or maybe Don had some, but I didn't have any more involvement with him in the book. There was a book in front of us. He was looking at it, had no complaints, went through all the pages. No, I mean, there wasn't anything to be said that I know of, except the time that he said he wanted it to be more like it could have come from an actual game.
Okay. Yeah. And you mentioned when we chatted briefly last week that the most up-to-date figure you're aware of is over 1.25 million copies sold.
Yeah, I'm not really sure, but that's about right.
That's amazing. Congratulations.
You know, one other problem we had in the book that nobody has ever had with a book before, I'll bet, is a little later after Bobby was world champion, and we wanted, you know, the book was coming out and he was getting his royalty checks. The royalty checks would come back saying no one at this address with that name. He was sort of hidden. It was hard to send him a royalty check.
Wow.
But finally we got somebody who could always tell us where he was, and through her, we could send him the checks.
And those were the days when he was most likely needed the money most, right? Living like a pauper.
I don't know. It's funny. The money thing then was really quite obscure to me. Don and I both considered, or at least certainly I remember I did, making arrangements where he would get our royalties. But we didn't know what financially was happening. Anyway, we have kind of lost all that. We certainly intended to get him his royalty checks. Not that I wasn't the one who was concerned with it, but the people at Xerox couldn't find them to send them. It was Shernaz Kennedy,
right,
who could tell us where to send the checks. We were very grateful that she would trust us with Bobby's address, but I guess under the circumstances, it was an easy decision for her.
Yeah, yeah, it makes sense. And was it in California?
I don't know who. I don't remember what address. I mean, I remember she gave me the address, and I remember giving it to the Xerox people, but I don't remember anything about what the address was.
Okay, yeah, just amazing. I mean, of course, if you read Dr. Brady or John Donaldson's works about Fisher, which are well worth reading. I mean, it seems like so many people tried to help him, you know, when they were able to, especially financially. There's, you know, he could have done so little to be comfortable, but just couldn't or wouldn't.
Well, there was a time that the people from the Worldwide Church of God came to see us. They wanted Bobby to write a series on the middle game, and that would have kept Bobby busy and would have yielded a lot of money. But I don't know why nothing ever came of it.
Did they want Bobby to write it, or did they want you guys to write it and put Bobby's name on it?
I wouldn't phrase it that way, that we would write it and put Bobby's name on it. We would write it with Bobby if we were going to write it, but neither of us had any interest in writing another book with Bobby. Not that we had any trouble with the first, but our life had gone different directions.
Yeah, and I would like to hear more about your research shortly. But Stuart, just to wrap up the endlessly fascinating topic of Fisher and this book in particular, so what is your most cherished Fisher memory? I mean, as someone who got to play him so many times, is it beating him, or is there another one that stands out?
Well, I'm embarrassed to say this, but the thing that you said is what is my most cherished memory.
You shouldn't be. Yeah, that would definitely be mine as well. And
But, you know, also, I won a lot of games against Bobby. For example, sometimes we would, after he gave me pawn and four, we'd get into rook and pawn endings where I might have king, rook, and five pawns against king, rook, and two, and I might win those games too. And that would please me a great deal too. Most of the time, if I would get into, say, king, rook, and four, with me having king, rook, and four, and Bobby having king, rook, and three, I could just resign. I couldn't hold it. If a king, rook, and pawn ending a pawn ahead would be hopeless for me to try to win, try to even draw. I mean, Bobby somehow, nobody seems to make such a fuss about how terribly difficult it was to play king, rook, and pawn endings with him.
Huh. Yeah, he was amazing at all phases of the game. Well, Stuart, we're going to take one more break, and then I've got a few listener questions for you related to your research. I've been digging deeper, looking at my analytics on aimchess.com, specifically trying to improve my time management at Blitz Chess, as you guys have heard me discuss before. They have this tab called Long Thinking, where you can look to see what the outcome of moves where you spend a lot of time is. And for me, it turns out those moves tend to be better than average compared to my rating peers. So my issue is I just need to play a little bit faster every single move. It's not so much about avoiding the long things. And there's tons of insights you can get like that from aimchess.com. You can check it out for free. Explore all phases of your game with actionable drills that you can then review and download games where issues arise. So check it out for free. And if you subscribe, use the promo code perpetual30 on aimchess.com.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18+.
And we are back. And Stuart, we have a question from a supporter of the podcast. Those who support the podcast via Patreon or PayPal can find out the guests and submit questions for them in advance. And this one is from Thanush Thambin, who says, Fischer Teaches Chess was my first chess book. I had no chess knowledge prior to that except how pieces move. I was wondering what distinguishes the way the book was presented that helps so many newbies get better with zero instructions or words. Can this method be taken into other areas of chess development? Of course, there are words in there, but I think he's mainly referring to no chess notation.
Well, I think a lot of people have since decided that they could get along without chess notation, and they could get along with one big picture on a page. And so I think that is now fairly commonly seen. And the idea of doing it with the B.F. Skinner approach, which hardly anybody would notice or talk about, is also very appealing to me. But I don't think that will take off because B.F. Skinner's work is not so well known, and it isn't so clear what you have to do in chess to make it such that everybody could go from page one to page two to page three without any difficulty. So that is a method which is used in many other places beside chess, and I think it could be used if people write about the chess middle game and the chess end game, I would think that would be a very appropriate tool for them to use. But I don't know if that will happen because it's not so well known.
Okay. Yeah, and we had another listener question. This one's from Tyron Ross Price, and he asks, what have you learned about the learning process that would improve Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess, and have you considered making a Chessable course, which I can tell you about Chessable if need be, Stuart?
You know, I don't know enough about Chessable courses to know about.
Yeah, well, so what I was going to say, what I can tell you is it's based on spaced repetition, basically. So, you know, to me, it actually, you know, this is not my field of expertise, but program learning sounded like a sort of distant cousin, because there is a lot of testing involved with spaced repetition to make sure that you're retaining the material that you learn. So Chessable is kind of, you know, it's a chess startup that's cropped up in the past 5 years, and they've really advanced the field of chess learning by frequently, especially with opening sequences and tactical patterns. They help you learn a lot. But I'm guessing that you're retired from books, courses.
Well, I'd like to learn about it. It sounds quite compelling.
Oh, yeah. Well, we can talk more about it when we're not recording. I should obviously, regular listeners know they're a sponsor of the podcast. So I'm not trying to derail this into an infomercial, but I am a legitimate fan of it. But basically, to answer the rest of Tyron's question, it sounds like you're not working on any new chess material currently.
No, we're not working on any new chess material currently.
And well, sorry, go ahead.
Well, one thing that we were interested in for a while, but it's very obscure, is what is the beauty in chess? And many people have said that they find just some chess moves beautiful, or even many chess moves beautiful, or even all of chess beautiful. And so one thing we were doing was research into what makes a move beautiful. And it takes a long time to say what we've discovered. But we now think that once we have some idea of what makes chess beautiful, that the very rules of chess developed over hundreds of years were in part influenced by a desire to keep chess being an activity that had a lot of beauty in it. And if we were going to work on something else, we would certainly work on trying to understand that better.
Yeah, I don't know if you've come across Grandmaster Jonathan Levitt's book, Secrets of Spectacular Chess, but he kind of opines about that question some. It's definitely worth checking. It's a great book, first of all.
Yeah, I'd like to read that then, Jonathan Levitt. Yeah, Levitt's book, yeah, definitely. That would be definitely interesting.
Yeah, but it is, it's a fascinating, you know, general topic, how chess just endures, how, you know, invented so many centuries ago and more popular than ever today. Do you have any broader theories about what makes the game so compelling?
No, I don't. I mean, I do think that elements of beauty are just infused in chess. And indeed, one of the concerns I've always had is that whether random chess, which solves the problem of having people get all prepared and having computer preparation, but whether the rules of random chess allow for as much beauty in a chess game as the current rules, or whether one could change random chess so that you could get more beauty into it. But those would be complicated questions to solve.
Yeah, I wonder about that as well. I'm skeptical, I have to say, that it can hold up, although I do understand that, especially at the professional level, the opening memorization can be overwhelming. And Stuart, I'd also like to talk about your research a little bit. Of course, you've written about the effects of chess on reading scores. I read the paper that I could find online, but I know I believe you've written more than one paper. Could you summarize both your research and how you would update it, or what has changed in the many years since that's been written?
Well, one problem for me has been, when people do research studies in schools, they usually try to complete the study within a semester or two semesters. And a lot of the time has to be spent, if you're dealing with kids who are 9 and 10 and 11, with teaching them the rules. And there's only so many hours that they play in during the rest of the semester. So when you're talking about whether playing chess helps you to learn to read, you're usually talking about a very small amount of playing chess, because they might play an hour or two a week after they've had 10 weeks or so of getting really familiar with how to play. So it's very hard to get a good result. I did do one study where it showed that people who had learned to play chess were showing a bigger gain in reading score than people who hadn't learned to play chess. But when I did the study over again, I didn't get the same result. And it seems really not replicable, and not easily replicable. So my present thinking is that chess is somewhat helpful, but very little helpful, just barely. It's uncertain whether you get, in one semester of playing chess, whether you get any gain at all in ability to do well in reading or math. I just plain know. I don't think anybody would know. But one thing we did learn is that if you had a chess club, the people who came to the chess club were, you know, it's voluntary, come anybody, no pressures of any kind. But the people who chose to come and to play turned out to be the best students in the school, turned out to have the highest scores in reading in the school. And nobody said, oh, that shows that if you play chess, you get to be very good in school. Everybody said, well, people who are very smart and very good readers come and like to play chess, but it isn't chess that did it. But of course, some people might think chess is of some help in that. It's really just quite unknown at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, all of us chess teachers, you know, we believe that chess, I mean, first, we hope it's helpful, but more broadly, I think at least it can't be bad. But I know that, you know, these studies, they remind me a bit of nutrition studies where, like, the science changes over the years. And just when you think one thing is true, another thing is discovered, and it can be very hard to isolate variables. But, I mean, to me, it's admirable that you did attempt to replicate the study and that you're forthcoming about the fact that you didn't have the same results the second time around.
Well, one thing that did happen is the principals of the Bronx schools where we were doing the study, at the beginning, when we first came there, were quite negative on allowing kids to play chess in the classroom because they said, you know, we want kids to gain in reading and math. How well we're evaluated as principals depend on how well our kids do. We just can't have them wasting a lot of time messing around playing chess. But the principals gave up that criticism when they saw that it might help and it might not, but it wasn't hurting. And so that what you just said now, I think, is how the principals would generally feel. Okay, if you want to mess around playing chess, it's okay with me because it's not going to be harmful. And indeed, even in some countries, or at least in one country, I think it was Armenia, they decided that all the kids could learn to be helpful.
Yeah, and of course, Armenia has churned out some amazing chess players as a result. And yeah, Tatyev Abrahamian, Armenian turned American chess champion, has talked about learning chess in schools there. And obviously, another converted American, Levon Aronian, did quite okay with his chess. Now, Stuart, another sort of related question is, In Asa's book, he also mentions that you played some other games. Like, of course, Asa famously plays many games. But he mentions you playing Scrabble. Are you an avid Scrabble player as well?
Yeah, I did play a lot of Scrabble. And when I grew up, people who played chess did not play so much in the Marshall or Manhattan or Log Cabin or any of the other chess clubs. People who played chess when I grew up, played in the Flea House, 42nd Street Chess Club. I'm sure a lot of people who, if you've interviewed a lot of people who are older, they said that was where they played chess when they grew up. There'd be dozens of, you could go in an afternoon on a Saturday, and there'd be dozens of chess games going on there. But if you went to the Marshall Chess Club, you might have three or four games at best. So the Times Square Chess Club is where people went to play chess and to play Scrabble. There was a lot of Scrabble play there. So if you went up there to play chess regularly, you'd be bound to have learned to play Scrabble.
Okay. And did you take your Scrabble seriously?
No, I wasn't all that good at it. I played for a little bit. My wife loves to play, so I play with her. But, I mean, I do like the game of Scrabble very much, and the flea house, and certainly the reason they call it the Flea House today, I think if you ask somebody why is it called the flea house? They'd say it's kind of a disreputable, or was kind of a disreputable place, like a flea house. But that isn't why it got the name of the flea house. Long ago, about, 50 or 60 years ago, on the corner of 42nd Street and 8th Avenue, we would get out of the subway to go to the chess club. There was Hector's Flea Circus. And so essentially you'd go to Hector's Circus and then wind up playing chess. I mean, you get off at Hector's Circus and play chess. Hence, it became became the flea house. And the place where people played.
Yeah, and Asa, of course, in his book, describes so many legendary New York figures. Rosalimo. Did you ever play Rosalimo?
Oh, I played a lot with Rosalimo. Yes, he was one of my favorite players. And I even played Judith Polgar, a 10-year-old Judith Polgar, in Rosalimo's club when I was young.
Wow, amazing. How'd that game go?
It was a draw.
Oh, great. Yeah.
I'm very pleased with it. I often tell people, I played that Judith Polgar. Yeah, we drew. Yeah. I didn't say that was a 10. If she was 10 and a half, I wouldn't have had a chance.
Yeah, you got her just in time. You wait 6 more months and it's all over.
That's what it would have been. Yeah. Yeah. Nicky Rosalimo was, of course, a wonderful person to have there.
Yeah, and so he has,
also the ones played beautiful chess. I mean, he really cared about beauty and chess. Glorious, anyway.
Yeah, no, I mean, I'd love to hear more stories. Did you visit, he had a chess venue, I don't know what to call it. Did you visit his chess store?
Have you ever had a glass of water? Have you ever had a hamburger? Yeah, of course I did.
So that was another place to play.
Yeah, I would say that it competed with the Flea House because the Flea House had a very strong player who played there all the time, was always available, came there every afternoon, made his living at it. A lot of people have made their living at chess just playing for small stakes, but the Flea House had one player. You may not know him. His name was Abe Turner, but he was a very strong player, and he was there every day. But Nicky's place had Nicky, so
right.
You could play with Nicky. So those are the two places that were most desirable. But Nicky's place came much later.
Okay, this is Nicky Rosalimo, of course. And so in these encounters, would you, as a matter of course, play them for money, Stuart?
Yes, as a matter of course, I would play for money. Yeah.
Okay, and were you expecting? Were you expecting to hold your own, or were you just kind of like?
Gosh.
I mean, obviously, in the case of someone like Rosalimo, he could give odds. But the point is, you were okay with losing a bit of money.
Of course,
okay.
Of course. Are you kidding? It was so little to lose and to play Nicky. Yeah. Oh yeah. Play Nicky and play Abe Turner too. Yeah. Sure, it's great. It's amazing to me that I could get along just losing so little money. You know, you have all these people make a living. Or not all these, but some people who make a living playing chess for small stakes, make a living at money, professional chess players. But there's also a stack of us who enjoy our lives regularly losing to these people.
Right.
You'd have to have a lot of us for a few of them. So, yeah, it was great.
Well, it's good that you have that attitude. And in your aforementioned study, you mentioned one of the people that you thank for your help with the project is a young Maurice Ashley. How well have you known Maurice over the years?
Not at all. I mean, I played with him a few times, but that's all. I really don't have very little connection with him.
Okay. And in terms of like legendary New York City chess figures, Stuart, is there anyone that you feel like we haven't mentioned that we should have?
Well, not a legendary chess figure, maybe, but I have to think of his name. They call him the Fox because of his involvement with the Lindbergh kidnapping. His name will come to mind in a bit. It was always interesting to me to play him, there were quite older players who had come around sometime. It was always exciting to me to play one of these people who knew everybody from the old days. not sure how well I remember their names without thinking about it. Kupchik was one of them. I don't know if you've ever heard that name. But these were people who were much older than me. I mean, I was a young kid, and they knew. I mean, they played with Emmanuel Lasker and that group. They were really exciting to talk to. And even a younger player, you know, the guy who plays on the street corner or played on the street corner in New Orleans for all those years.
Jude Acers?
Yeah, Jude Acers. Talking to Jude Acers was terribly exciting for me because Jude Acers knew everywhere that Paul Morphy had played. He could take me to the house where he was born, to where he played. He could tell me the names of people he played with and what they did. So I was very taken by connections with guys like that who knew some of the older players.
Yeah.
Jude Acers is one of those players. It's amazing to me that he made his living all those years on that little corner in New Orleans.
Yeah, I've never met him in person, just exchanged a few emails. Shout out to Jude if you're listening. I'd love to get to play him sometime. And Stuart, just to tie it up, how did you get into chess to begin with? What was your entry into the game?
My uncle taught me to play one day, and then it turned out that a second uncle of mine was Irving Chernoff, a distant relative.
Oh, wow.
And my uncle got Irving to come in and play with me and give me his book. That was very exciting. And somehow or other, then I started to play.
I mean, Irving must have been an absolute walking chess encyclopedia. I mean, his enthusiasm for chess is obviously, it's so evident in his books.
Well, I wish I had more connection with him, but I didn't. Just he came to the house once and he gave me queen odds, and he got four moves, and I think it's amazing. This is the first time I've thought of this in 60 years is to think of the time I met him and how he played. It's really quite distant.
Okay.
And other places too. There was the Rice Progressive Chess Club. Probably nobody that you've ever interviewed has ever been to the Rice Progressive Chess Club, probably closed 60 years ago. But it was an exciting place. It had been taken over by cards because the guy who ran it, who crushed me whenever we played, he was so strong, a chess player, had become a card player and made a very good living playing Spanish pinochle with local people for high stakes.
I love it. Yeah, so much game history in New York City. And how old were you, Stuart, when you learned to play chess?
I was 12, maybe, when I first found the Rice Progressive, or 13 or 14, when I found the Rice Progressive Chess Club. It was strange. There was no chess in the Rice Progressive Chess Club. There was the bottom floor had chess pieces, old chess pieces, and then you have to go up the stairs, which you weren't welcome to do, where they were playing cards for very high stakes. And they kept the tables down at the bottom floor for chess in case the police came to raid. If the police wanted to raid, they'd have to go through the chess club and then walk up these flight of stairs, which was very hard to walk up to deal with the people who were playing for really high-stake money regularly. And this was this place that had just these chess pieces. And every once in a while, the guy whose name I'd have to remember would come down. He was maybe fourth or fifth best player in the country in his time. Extremely strong. And he would come down, and maybe once a month he would drag himself down and play a few games of his old love chess, which he'd given up for playing high-stake pinochle. And he just crushed me.
And you'd be down there waiting, or there'd be other people playing?
Came, too. I mean, some of my friends came down to see him, and they were good players, Elliot Hurst and Jimmy Sherwin.
Yeah.
All those players, they were got crushed by him, too.
Wow, amazing stories. And what about, I'm just thinking aloud of sort of New York chess figures, like Fred Reinfeld or Al Horowitz. Did you intersect with them at all?
Al Horowitz, plenty, but Fred Reinfeld, never.
Okay. Any
and Al Horowitz gave me very big odds in chess, but he was unable to win at the big odds he gave me. He lost almost every game. And Bobby said, you know, the strong player should know not to give more odds than he can. He's supposed to know all that. But he said he's just too ego involved. He won't play you with it. Anyway, that's what I remember about Al Horowitz. Other than that, he was just, including that, he was just a fine person to play with. Way, way, way stronger than me. Okay. Very good player.
And of course, he also sold a lot of chess books. You know, when to bring it back to Bobby Fischer Teaches Chess, when you were writing this book, was your vision behind it primarily to share your knowledge of chess, to utilize program learning? Like what drove you to
utilize program learning was my main interest. I especially would have liked to teach my girlfriend to play a little bit, she was the one who made us expand the number of pages enormously, because although she's very smart, she just couldn't do a checkmate, couldn't tell when it was checkmate or not, needed practice, and had to put in, is there any place for the king to escape? Is there any piece that can intervene? You know, had to put in all of that sort of stuff, pages of it, in order for her to do it. But I was interested in just using Skinner's work as a tool. I was working with doing Skinner's work, that program instruction work, and other things when tried to apply it to chess.
Well, I can't imagine how many people have learned chess. Well, I guess I can. Could be 1.25 million.
I suspect, yeah. I mean, if you sell a million books, a lot of people, like one person gets the book and three read it.
Yeah, well, I've only bought three of them, Stuart. I can only account for three of them. One when I was a kid, one in the past couple of years, and then there was a time when I was donating chess books to a jail and purchasing new books, and I reached out to the guy who gave the books to the prisoners, Troy, and he specifically requested your book because of its lack of notation, because he was saying there are people in jail who love chess and want to learn chess but can't read, so it's the perfect book for
you. That's really nice to hear that there are people who liked it under those circumstances. That's very, very pleasing to hear.
And again, thank you for this book, Stuart. This has been amazing. Before we let you go, is there anything else you'd like to discuss, whether it be related to your research or stories that you haven't yet had the chance to tell?
No, one thing I think is that there's something, there's another aspect of chess that nobody ever mentions that I have seen become very important to people, and that is I had a friend, about a 2100 player, who had very serious surgery and was in a great deal of pain. And he said that reading chess magazines, reading chess books, allowed him to somehow turn his attention when he needed to away from his physical pain and just to get deeply absorbed in chess. And since then, I've met quite a few people who have found that they need to distract themselves. If they want to turn away, if they want to do something that they'll care about, when things are really bothering them, that chess is a solution to that problem. And I've just been impressed that people can, even under the very difficult circumstances, if they need to do something that they'll care about and will turn their attention away from their troubles, chess succeeds in doing it. I don't know if other things do that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I certainly, there have been times in my life where you just get enveloped in it. And yeah, sometimes when something else is bothering you, it can be a great escape. That's well said. And I thought of another question for you, Stuart. Just out of curiosity, do you follow top-level chess? And is that something you've kept up with over the years?
For this program, I called four of my friends that I played chess with in college. So they're all my age. And I asked them all, do you have any involvement in chess at 90? And three of the four play online every once in a while. They continue at 90 to continue to play online. And all of them have read the magazines or read newspapers or something, and have, they all know what big tournaments are on. They all know Carlsen's name, even though a lot of years have passed since they played. They still have some involvement, still some love of it that stays all their lives.
That's amazing.
Me too. I'm in the same boat.
That's amazing. And so it's, I don't know if it's that or something else, but it's awesome that you guys all are still around, still in such good health.
Yeah, there used to be a time when people said you could ward off Alzheimer's with chess.
Right.
But I tried to see if there was any truth in it, and I found that I couldn't get enough information to know if it's true.
Yeah, that's another one where I don't consider the science entirely settled, but it can't be bad. I know Beatrice Marinello is doing a lot of work, Checkmate Dementia, to help promote chess to older people.
Okay, wow. I didn't know that people had been doing some work. And it's pretty hard to get some research that you could trust in this field.
Yeah, unfortunately, but again, I mean, obviously, using your mind constructively and just the anecdote you told, or anecdata, I guess you could say, is a small check in the column of helping maintain mental fitness. Well, Stuart, this has been fantastic. Last question. Do you have any general sort of non-chess advice for maintaining one's health to the age of 89 and counting?
I can't say that I know much about what would work.
It's really impressive how well you remember all these stories and how sharp you still are in conversation.
Well, I hope I remember all the stories as they actually happen and not as I've distorted them over the years. But it does seem like that isn't what... I mean, I do feel like some of it was so impactful on me that I still remember a lot.
Are you like a healthy eater? Do you drink? Do you exercise? Let's get a few more nuggets.
I go three times a week to the gym where I work with a physical therapist. But it's kind of very mild work. I don't know that people would be impressed by how mild my exercise regime is, but I do it.
And are you doing? You reading a lot? Doing any chess puzzles? What about
mental? Yeah, I do read a lot. And one thing I read a lot of is new in chess. But I have a rule in New in Chess. I don't know if anybody else would ever have this rule. But I have a rule in New in Chess. When I'm feeling, I sometimes have acid stomach, a difficulty that can really distract me. And the rule I have is when New in Chess comes in, I leave it in its wrapping. And if I'm suddenly bothered by some... Then I come inside, I take some Tums, and I open up New in Chess and let myself just sink into it.
That's great. Yeah, it is a fantastic way to keep up with the chess news. Always great pictures and great game analysis. And do you have, I keep saying it's my last question, but I keep thinking of one more. Do you have a favorite chess book that helped you along the way, Stuart?
I've read really... Very, 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 very little in the way of chess books. I don't know why I didn't try to enhance my chess much. By far, the books I've liked the most have been the Cezanko books.
Yeah.
They don't teach you so much to play chess as they're just glorious books, I think.
You've got good taste, Stuart. Yeah, Grandmaster Jenna Sasanko has some great sort of chess history and memoirs and just stories of his interactions with so many legends, especially Soviet legends.
Yeah, and he's such a person. He's so appealing a person.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's my favorite of the in the chess world, I think.
So to get to
the chess books that I read.
So to get to
I have other books.
What other books? Are you a fiction reader, nonfiction?
Well, I certainly liked all the chess fiction. I certainly loved all the chess fiction. There's one chess fiction that nobody seems to have ever heard of. The standard work, Nabokov, of course, and names won't come to mind for a minute, but you know, all the standard ones are just really first rate. But there's also one that nobody has ever heard of that I thought was just great, and it was called The Change of Air, and it's written by Ivan Gold, and it takes place in the chess club on 14th Street. I don't know why it never got to be more popular. It won the O. Henry Short Story Award for the year, and I never see it in any chess publications. But anyway, that's another one of those.
Okay.
I think if there's anything about chess that comes up somewhere, there's a good chance I'll get to it, even if it, especially if it doesn't have any moves. And of course, Frank Brady's book was terribly impressive to me.
Yeah. Yeah. Endgame or Profile of a Prodigy? Or?
Yeah. Well, I didn't like Profile of a Prodigy so much as I liked the second one of them.
Endgame. Yeah. Fantastic book.
And
his descriptions of Fischer, I mean, I know you're quoted in the book here and there, but his descriptions of Fischer rang true to you?
Yes. Although there's one thing I hold against Frank, and that is I felt that the last part of the book, he was kind of pulled his punches a little on how weird Bobby had become at the very end, and what his broadcasts were, the Spanish broadcasts.
Yeah.
They were, I think that Frank really kind of was very mild on that.
Yeah.
And,
yeah, it's a fair criticism. It's tough when these guys are your heroes, you know? You worship one thing they do, and then they're just reprehensible in other ways. It's fine line to walk.
Many people don't. You know, the question of what to say about in the chess museum about Bobby has bothered many people here and there. I think what they decided to do is right, but some people wish to have much more of the negatives of Bobby included. I don't think so, but anyway, that's a difficult problem for everybody to solve.
Yeah, it is. But I think you've, for better or for worse, it doesn't do any good to hide it, unfortunately. And truly the last question, Stuart, since now that I know that you've read very few chess books, how did you become a master at a time when there were not that many chess masters?
There were not that many chess. The list was really quite modest. Playing in the Flea House, that's how I got to be a better player. Flea House, one time, not one time, but many times, I would get to the Flea House at 4 in the morning because I had a job that finished at 3:30 in the morning, and sometimes I wouldn't want to go to bed. And I could go to the Flea House at 4 in the morning and still find chess players. It was really... And Scrabble players, too, especially Scrabble players. I don't know why. But I learned to play in the Flea House, mostly. And, of course, in Jack Collins' house, too. Jack Collins was very receptive.
Yeah, and of course, he had a legendary chess library, but you were mainly playing there?
I never read one of Jack's books. I didn't even know he had a legendary library, yeah.
And were you going over?
I never hardly ever read a chess book.
Were you going over the games, Stuart, after you played? Or
No. Just, I never
wow,
went over
you're
the
like
games. Never got to be good, and never got to have a positional sense. Never was a strategist. If it wasn't mating by sacking the queen, it's about the best I could do.
Okay. Well, it worked. And Stuart, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing all of these awesome stories.
Me too. It's a real joy to talk to you.
Thanks to everyone who helps make Perpetual Chess possible. Big shout out to my producer, Matthew Passy. I'd also like to thank the Blue Wire Podcast Network, with whom we are proud to be affiliated. Be sure to follow us on social media, BennyFishel1 on Twitter, at Perpetual Chess on Instagram, or you can join the Perpetual Chess Facebook group. You can email me, ben@perpetualchesspod.com. And of course, last but not least, I'd like to give major thanks to the Perpetual Chess Patreon and PayPal supporters. Those who choose to join that community based on their level of support can do things like submit questions for guests of the show, have access to live Zoom Q&A lectures with grandmasters who often have appeared on the show, going over chess games, answering questions, stuff like that. And you can even get access to ad-free Perpetual Chess if that's your preference. So, but most of all, thanks to everyone for listening, and we will catch you all on the next episode.
Social Podcast Network.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.